of space were gathered in here. One feels the heritage of the native people. One feels the vibration of the religion of the Christ. The dome seems to descend upon us, so there's a luminous atmosphere created. But the atmosphere is so overawing that if we're not careful, we may lose touch with each other. And so one request I would make is to come together a little more, if you're happy to do so. We have some chairs in the front. Maybe we can all be a little bit closer.
Say the words of the invocation, we speak
speak clearly of where the path leads. Toward the one. And so today, our subject is the one. And the saying of Moshut that is ours to contemplate this morning is, God is what is wanted to complete oneself. Now let me begin with a story. Maybe you've heard it before, but I think it's one of those stories that gets told often enough. Story of an angel who was present when the divine voice urged all of the angels to bow down in reverence before a new creation, that new creation being the human being. Many angels immediately prostrated because God had asked this of them. But there were some who paused in a state of confusion, looking at this thing to which they were now asked to bow down, this thing of clay, and anticipating already what would come in the future from this thing, this human thing, what bad things were in store, and therefore hesitating. Beings who were made of light, beings whose only work was to glorify and praise the One, now being asked to seemingly turn away from the One toward a multitude of creatures of clay who, unlike themselves, were destined to forget the One and commit all manner of strife. So you can perhaps appreciate the dilemma of this angel. And seeing the angel's hesitation, another angel who was very close to the throne proposed, "Let us put him to the test." And so with the divine consent, this angel was sent down to earth. And to have one's feet really upon the earth requires incarnation. The disembodied angels can visit and see certain things and dispense a certain guidance and inspiration, but to be a terrestrial witness in the fullest sense requires incarnation. And so, in accordance with the intention of the test, this angel was made to incarnate in human form and materialized on the branch of a tree. It happened to be an apple tree. And the angel looked and saw on the nearby branch a ripe red apple. And immediately was drawn, intrigued, plucked to the apple, looked on it with great interest, and then bit in. Ah, what a taste, that sweet, tangy, juicy savor of the apple. It ate more and more. Ate the apple entirely and looked for others and ate them too. This would be interesting, this earthly adventure. Then the angel looked down and saw there was a young woman under the apple tree selling apples. The apple had seemed a beautiful thing, but this young lady seemed even more lovely. And so the angel descended and engaged her in conversation. And she was not only good to look at, but wonderful to converse with. Her personality and blossomed with every word, and soon this angel was in love. And the young lady herself developed a fondness for this mysterious visitor from the branches, and they became friends, and at last romantically attached. They were married, and following their marriage, the first child came, then the second child, and the third. And then the selling of apples was insufficient to provide the needs of the family. They had to go into other kinds of business, move into the city. And there were all kinds of complications, stresses. Life became beleaguered with provocations, riddled with distractions. There were friends, but also enemies and fierce ones. There were insults and injuries and diseases. There was heartache. Though they had come together in love, now they found themselves quarreling. And the vividness of that first bite of the apple now paled whenever the angel bit into an apple. The taste seemed strangely dulled. The sky looked bleak. And the angel was depressed. What was life all about? Then descended an angel from the heavens and seized hold of his erstwhile companion and said, "My friend, wake up. Remember, you've come from on high. You're a visitor here. Remember the realms of glory. Remember the tides of illumination. Remember the exaltation of nearness to the proximity of the infinite beauty." And the angel visitor was shaken awake, and he said, "Yes, yes, I have fallen into deep distraction. I have forgotten the origin and the goal, succumbed to intoxication, my senses dulled, my soul concealed under layer upon layer of negligence and worry and fretfulness. Yes." And he was summoned to the divine court and now came before the throne as a penitent. He looked down upon the earth and saw that there, in that place where he had lost his way, facing the very same limitations and grappling with all the same struggles, manage to remember God and to glorify and to be of service and to offer pure love to the world. And when he saw this, he bowed down and said, "I am entirely ready now to honor the human being who, in the midst of all limitation and all of the vagaries of the manifest state, the human being who still, throughout it all, remembers God, that humanity has my deepest reverence." There is a little bit of that angel in all of us, because we have all come from on high, all descended through the spheres, step by step, and each step has been another discovery. The soul is drawn to explore the horizon of manifestation, the frontier. We're pioneers. Hearing reports from those returning from the terra incognita, from the land beyond, as they return, they bring reports, and our questing soul, making its way, is drawn to advance, and every step forward produces new sensations. The sensations of this body are unbeknownst to the angels in heaven, and yet, at the same time, there occurs an incremental forgetting. And that forgetting progresses as the soul descends through the spheres. As we are born into the world, given a name, held up before the mirror, and shown a self that is now assigned to us, as that self has then to be defended against bullies and critics, as that self struggles to feed itself, clothe itself, assert its will, a kind of encapsulation more and more occurs, which is the crystallization of the ego. In some sense, this is a fall from grace, a descent into separation. And if that descent lands us in a state of individuality in which there is no space for communion, for community, for the surpassing of the boundaries of the ego, then the consequence, individually and collectively, is just as the anxious angels feared: strife on earth, the violence that men and women do to each other, and which we see every day when we read the news. The last days have been upwelling of violence, terror, inhumanity, injustice, absence of kindness. It's all the raging of this egoic forgetfulness, this losing of the soul in narrowly conceived identities imagined to be at war with each other. And yet we had to enter the body, we had to enter the ego. This descent was and is mandated, belongs to the whole cycle. It is the prelude to the homecoming, in which there is unspeakable joy. Exile is the prelude to homecoming. Veiling is the prelude to unveiling. Forgetfulness is the prelude to remembrance. And so Moshe said, I thanked the darkness which prepared me for the vision of the light. But we're only halfway there. This is not the time to stop. God is what is wanted to complete oneself. All of this has been brought forth by choose the word you wish for. God, the source, the creator, love itself. All this has been brought forth by the cause of all causes. Every effect has a cause, and if you trace back the causes, there is an ultimate cause. Otherwise, none of this could have been. There is a wellspring from which all emerges. And by the power of it, this has been given. So, the universe is dispensed. Our own souls and hearts and minds and bodies are provided by the divine providence. All of this has been given in a great exhalation. But now comes the turn, and what follows is the inhalation, the return. That's why we're gathered here. This interest of ours in the matters of the spirit is no mere hobby. It's the very trajectory of creation. This is what is asked of us. This is that for which the universe exists. It has been given forth that the answer may come and that we may be returned. Otherwise, the work is only half done. And now our involvement is needed. Hitherto we were thrust into life. We didn't request our own creation. It was given. The divine love precedes human love. comes first, which is for each of us. We have been engendered through the divine. Love for each of us, love for what may be, that is axiomatic. But that having been given now, there is, as it were, a pause, a suspense. This is given now. What? And now the turn is ours. What is the answer? And here our will comes into play, our freedom, the return requires of us an act of will. Because otherwise our return would be loveless, would be mechanized, an automated response. But it isn't. We've been given this living, breathing heart. We've been given the message. The message has been given again and again. And then there is this suspense to see when will our answer come. And the response comes through an interweaving of the divine will and the human will. It isn't only something by our sheer force that we accomplish. No, there's divine will in it. But divine will in accord with that which we choose to take one step forward, and the divine being approaches with 10 steps. This will to return naturally grows and evolves with the deepening of our understanding of life. When that understanding is as yet superficial, the will to return is very faint indeed. But as through trial and error, through life experience, we learn, and oftentimes learn through loss and longing, more and more the picture becomes clear. It's like an unfocused image that more and more comes into focus. When the picture is unfocused, the ego is simply concerned with itself as it understands itself, as a bounded entity, having little or nothing to do with anyone or anything else, and just seeking its own gratification. In that phase of life, one only wants to heap up luxuries, whatever is pleasurable, to have as much of it as one can, and to avoid anything even slightly unpleasant, wishes to be flattered and pampered and provided every means to assert dominance and and satisfaction. As many shiny things as are heaped up, as soon as it has them, no longer wants them, wants the next one, and that too gives no pleasure. It is again like eating dirt to satisfy hunger. It will not satisfy. And if one learns in this way, then one may reach that juncture where vision sees further. An immediate gratification is not so satisfying because obviously it will quickly fade. One wants a more lasting pleasure. Not only a stimulus to the body, but pleasure in the mind, peace of mind. And therefore, one's interest shifts from things to sensations, inner sensations. This leads to the pursuit, perhaps, of such disciplines of mind and body as can bring about a sense of well-being. It might also lead to consideration of the state in the hereafter and the wish to ensure that this state will be pleasurable, and that one's actions here and now will not preclude an unhappy hereafter. In this way, one is focused on sustainable happiness. But still further, may happen that the ego arrives at a realization that shatters even this farther-reaching materialism. And that realization is this, that all of these good things, whether good things of the body, good things of the mind, these are gifts. But who is the giver? Who has given all of this, and why? More importantly, even perhaps than who, why? What relationship do these gifts bear testimony to? It's as though one was the recipient of package after package in the mail, and one opened them, enjoyed them, threw them aside and kept looking in the box. But did one ever pause to read the return address? Or better yet, to write back? A note of thanks. And that is what prayer means. This is when prayer begins. Gratitude. To acknowledge blessings, which transforms our life, because to acknowledge blessings prayerfully is something more than simply to indulge in every possible enjoyment. It's another kind of enjoyment. It's a subtler, sweeter enjoyment. It gets at the root of the blessing. It isn't just to gobble things up, it's to savor them, to ruminate, and to follow the trail that leads from the pleasure back to its source, the beneficence of the giver of that pleasure. And this kind of alertness, day after day, opens up a world of blessings. Because when one begins to count them, to savor them, to acknowledge the giver in them, the blessings proliferate. Are there more blessings, or is it just that one is noticing them now and they therefore appear more multitudinous? We can say. But clearly one is no longer bemoaning one's fate, reciting the litany of one's grievances. One is remembering, lifting up praise, and basking in merciful sweetness. This is prayer. Now, second kind of prayer is when learning to live in gratitude, one is conscious when one slips, having been so profoundly endowed in body, in mind, in the presence of so much that is so good, in the immersion of sky and earth, of heat and light and flowing water, and the touch of the friend and the voice of the beloved and the trills of the birds, receiving all of this, then to fall into fear and anger, to misspeak, to blot this canvas of beauty with the smear, the mark of a misdirected action, a misspoken word, a kind of shock comes over oneself. What have I done? Now, so long as the ego is intoxicated, no such shock ever occurs. Nothing is shocking. It cannot surprise itself because it has no shame. But if one is more and more alive to beauty, then yes, one is aware of one's missteps, and then prayer becomes that humble act of turning toward the One as a refuge, and in acknowledging that there seems no other possibility that my the mess that I've made can be cleansed. It seems ineradicable. It seems like a solid fact now, forever and ever. There seems no way that it could ever be made right, except by the power of the purest, most perfect, most endless, graceful mercy. And that then is one's refuge. And to find it, to shelter in it, to trust in it, becomes a healing salve that makes life possible again. Then there is that prayer called supplication, which is having acknowledged the Creator as the provider of every kind of blessing, not only all that received in the course of one's days, but also the provider of the as yet untold beauties that lie in store. When one has acknowledged this and gained from it a deep confidence in life itself, when one has in this way come close to the one whom one still does not understand, one cannot conceivably comprehend intellectually, but when in spirit one has approached that mystery and found in it redemption for all of one's limitations, though still in all humility, despairing of ever being capable of truly knowing this being, this being of all beings, as the one ought to be known, still one seeks such knowledge, one seeks to know whatever one can, just as a lover wants to be acquainted with the beloved in every possible respect. And so one turns to the one in supplication, invoking the one in every matter pertaining to one's life. There is no sphere of one's life that one segregates as concerning only one's self in isolation. Every aspect, every feature, every element of one's life has meaning in relation, first and foremost, to the one being, to the real. Everything is from the one for the sake of the one. Even when the matter is unclear, then supplication raises its voice and asks, how may this matter be brought into accord with you? What is mine to do for you in this? When there is a loss, the prayer is, will you be with me in this loss? is lost to me. Whatever occurs, if there is a goal, may I attain this goal for your sake. May this goal bring me closer to you. May I do your work in this way. Nothing is kept at a remove from the bond which becomes the link at the very center of one's life. That bond is like the trunk of a tree, and all of the thinkings and doings of one's daily life are branches and leaves and blossoms from that trunk. One wants to know the one insofar as that is possible, to study the divine nature and to live that nature, because what is to know except to live? And so one studies the names, which are the qualities, the way in which the one manifests, witnessing them on the horizons and in oneself, seeking to invoke, to remember, and to walk in the light of each name as it descends upon you. In this way, one makes oneself more and more transparent to God, qualify yourself with the qualities of the beloved, which is to say, in studying the one you love, let that study be the practice of your actions, of your words, and of your thoughts, because only then comes knowledge. And it's a knowledge that is paradoxical, because it brings ever-deepening certainty, same time, profound bewilderment. Ever deepening faith in the real. Ever growing dedication and unification of one's life. And at the same time, this bewilderment that comes from dizzying absorption in the vastness, in the inscrutable mystery of a wonder that is beyond all reckoning. In this way, the study of the qualities leads on to a plunge into essence, which is like the calm in the center of the storm. The qualities are in motion, revealing meaning, giving rise to name and form, but at the center of it all, there is this nameless silence that is pure essence. your manifestation and indraws again. Amidst all of the transformations of spirits, this perfection is never violated, never suffers diminution. And even at our own lowest ebb, even when we are most lost, even in the depths of deepest forgetfulness, that completeness pervades us and pervades everything and is all in all. We invoke it when we intone the words Allah. Teach us thy loving.